A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big canvas. He's asking about the political trajectory of modern post-Soviet Russia. What is life actually like there right now? How entrenched is the regime's control? Has the country meaningfully progressed since the USSR collapsed, or even before that? And stepping further back, is this cold, dictatorial, anti-Western posture something baked into Russian history? Or is it a relatively recent development in the grand sweep of things? There's a lot to dig into here.
It's a great question, because the way most people talk about Russia flattens it into a single story, like it's always been this monolithic authoritarian fortress. The reality is way messier and more interesting. By the way, quick note, today's script is being written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, so we've got a new voice shaping the conversation.
Fresh neural pathways. Let's see how it handles Russian history. Should be a good test.
All right, let's start with the modern lived experience, because that's the part that gets buried under all the geopolitical analysis. What does daily life actually look like in Russia right now?
The Human Rights Watch World Report for this year paints a pretty grim picture. The state has effectively criminalized independent political activity and any public dissent against the war in Ukraine. We're talking about a legal environment where you can be prosecuted for spreading deliberately false information about the military, which in practice means any reporting that contradicts the Kremlin's narrative.
The penalties aren't symbolic. We're talking up to 15 years in prison. The report details how authorities have used this to silence journalists, activists, even regular citizens posting on social media. There was this case of a teacher in Siberia who got 7 years for anti-war comments in a private WhatsApp chat. That's the level of surveillance we're dealing with.
Here's what I think trips people up. You can walk around Moscow or St. Petersburg and see cafes full of people, restaurants thriving, a surface-level normalcy that makes it seem like the repression is somewhere else. The Nez Center published an analysis recently about how the Kremlin has managed to maintain what they call a stability compact with the population. Most Russians aren't politically active, and the regime has made a deliberate choice to leave daily life relatively untouched as long as you stay out of politics.
That's the bargain, right? You get economic stability, or at least the absence of the chaos of the 90s, and in exchange you don't ask questions about Chechnya or Ukraine or Navalny. What's interesting in the Nez Center report is how they're seeing that compact start to fray after 4 years of war. Inflation is eating away at wages. The labor shortage is acute because so many men have been mobilized, fled the country, or are working in the defense sector. You've got something like 1 million Russians who left after the invasion, and a disproportionate number of them are young, educated, urban professionals.
The brain drain is real. And it's not just the immediate post-invasion wave. Strategy's report from this year talks about social fault lines that are widening. There's a growing split between what they call the war economy winners and everyone else. If you're working in a defense plant in the Urals, your wages have probably gone up significantly. If you're a teacher or a doctor, your purchasing power has cratered.
The Jamestown Foundation had a really detailed piece on this. They're tracking what they describe as a deepening split within the elite itself. You've got the hardliner faction that wants total mobilization, a full war economy, and sees any compromise as betrayal. And then you've got a more pragmatic faction, people connected to the economic ministries and the central bank, who are looking at the long-term structural damage and getting very nervous. The article mentioned that behind closed doors, there's real anxiety about what happens when the war ends and all those defense sector jobs evaporate.
This is the thing about entrenched dictatorship. People imagine it as a single unified control panel with one guy pressing all the buttons. But even in a system as centralized as Putin's Russia, there are factions, competing interests, and genuine policy disagreements. They just happen in the shadows instead of in public.
The 2026 Duma elections are shaping up to be a fascinating stress test. The Nest Center has a separate report on how the Kremlin is preparing for them. They're not worried about losing, obviously. United Russia will win its supermajority, that's baked in. What they're worried about is turnout and enthusiasm. After 4 years of war, sanctions, and economic strain, the regime is concerned that apathy could look like weakness. So they're pouring resources into get-out-the-vote operations, using state employees as mobilized voters, and carefully managing which opposition candidates are allowed on the ballot to create the appearance of competition without any actual risk.
Which is a very Soviet technique, by the way. The USSR had elections too, with turnout numbers that Western democracies could only dream of, 99.7% participation. It's just that the outcome was never in question. So there's a direct institutional lineage there.
Let's talk about that lineage, because Daniel's question about whether Russia has always been this way gets to something really important. The short answer is no, but also yes, but mostly it's complicated.
That's the Herman Poppleberry nuance I come here for.
Here's what I mean. If you go back to the Kievan Rus period, the 10th through 13th centuries, you've got a polity that's deeply integrated with Europe. They're trading with the Byzantines, marrying into European royal families. Anna Yaroslavna, the daughter of Yaroslav the Wise, becomes Queen of France in the 11th century. This is not a civilization that sees itself as separate from or opposed to Europe.
The Mongol invasion in the 13th century is the real pivot point. You've got roughly 250 years of what historians call the Tatar Yoke, where the Russian principalities are vassals of the Golden Horde. That experience shapes Russian statecraft in a profound way. The Mongol model of governance was highly centralized, extractive, and intolerant of dissent. The Moscow princes who eventually emerge as the dominant power internalize a lot of those methods.
They had to, in a sense. The geopolitical environment of the Eurasian steppe was brutal. You're dealing with raids from the Crimean Khanate, pressure from the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the Teutonic Order to the northwest. There's a reason the Russian state developed this obsession with strategic depth and buffer zones. It's not paranoia if they really are out to get you.
Here's where I think the eternal authoritarian Russia narrative breaks down. There have been genuine reform movements and periods of relative openness throughout Russian history. The legal reforms of Alexander II in the 1860s abolished serfdom and created an independent judiciary and trial by jury. The Zemstvo system created local self-government. There was a real civil society emerging in the late imperial period.
The intellectual ferment was extraordinary. You've got the Slavophiles and Westernizers debating Russia's identity and future. You've got a literary culture that's producing Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov, who are wrestling with questions of freedom, faith, and the individual versus the state. This is not a society that's content to be an autocratic monolith.
The tragedy of 20th century Russia is that the Bolsheviks snuffed out that emerging pluralism. The Soviet Union wasn't just a continuation of Tsarist autocracy with better technology. It was something qualitatively different, a totalitarian system that sought to reshape human nature itself, and it was ideological in a way that the Tsarist system never was. The Tsars wanted obedience. The Bolsheviks wanted your soul.
They got 70 years to try. The Soviet experiment was, in many ways, a radical break with Russian history, not its fulfillment. The USSR was explicitly atheist in a deeply religious society. It was internationalist in a country with strong national traditions. It sought to abolish the market, the family farm, the church, all the institutions that had structured Russian life for centuries.
Which is why the post-Soviet transition was so disorienting. You didn't just have a change of government in 1991. You had the collapse of an entire worldview. Everything people had been told for three generations about how the world worked, who the good guys were, what progress looked like, all of it turned out to be a lie.
What replaced it, in the Yeltsin years, was chaos. I think it's impossible to understand Putin's popularity, especially in his first two terms, without understanding the trauma of the 90s. Life expectancy dropped by something like 5 years. The economy contracted by roughly 40%. The oligarchs grabbed state assets for pennies. Pensioners were selling their belongings on the street to survive. For a country that had been a superpower, the humiliation was profound.
Putin's pitch was simple. Stability, dignity, and a restoration of Russia's place in the world. And for a lot of Russians, especially outside the major cities, he delivered. The economy grew for 8 straight years. Living standards improved. The Chechen War was won, or at least contained. The state started functioning again.
The bargain was always authoritarian. From the very beginning, Putin centralized power, crushed independent media, went after the oligarchs who wouldn't stay in their lane, and systematically dismantled the institutions that might have checked his power. The Federation Council became a rubber stamp. Regional governors went from being elected to being appointed. The courts lost their independence.
This is where the question of entrenchment gets really interesting. How deep does the control actually go? Because on one level, it's total. The security services, the F, and its sister agencies have penetrated every institution of consequence. The media landscape is almost entirely state-controlled or self-censored. Opposition figures are exiled, imprisoned, or dead. The Duma is a theater of pretend.
On another level, the state's capacity is much weaker than it looks. The Nestena report talks about this. Russia is not North Korea or even China in terms of its ability to monitor and control its population. The state is often corrupt, inefficient, and unable to deliver basic services. There's a vast gap between the laws on the books and what actually happens on the ground. Regional governors have significant autonomy as long as they deliver votes and don't challenge the center politically.
Strategy's analysis made this point really well. They described the regime as a personalist autocracy with weak institutions. Everything depends on Putin. There's no Politburo, no collective leadership mechanism that can manage a succession. The system is designed around one man's judgment, one man's relationships, one man's grudges. That makes it brittle in ways that a more institutionalized authoritarian system wouldn't be.
The Jamestown piece on elite splits gets at this too. The factions aren't organized around institutions or policy platforms. They're organized around personal loyalty and access to Putin. When he's gone, there's no obvious mechanism for resolving the succession question without a potentially destabilizing power struggle.
The entrenchment is deep but also narrow. The regime can crush any individual opponent. It can monitor and intimidate. But it can't actually govern effectively across its vast territory. There's a reason why. When you look at infrastructure outside the major cities, so much of it is still crumbling. Soviet-era construction. The state can project power, but it struggles to project competence.
Let's talk about the anti-Western dimension, because Daniel asked whether that's baked in or new. Historically, it's been cyclical. There have been periods of intense Westernization and periods of intense reaction against it. Peter the Great built St. Petersburg as a window to Europe and forced the nobility to shave their beards and wear Western clothes. Catherine the Great corresponded with Voltaire and saw herself as an enlightened European monarch.
Then you get the reaction. The Decembrist Revolt in 1825 was led by young officers who had been exposed to liberal ideas during the Napoleonic Wars and wanted a constitutional monarchy. Nicholas I crushed it, and spent the next 30 years building an ideology of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality that positioned Russia as a distinct civilization fundamentally opposed to Western liberalism.
That pattern repeats. Reform and opening, followed by repression and closing. Alexander II's reforms, followed by Alexander III's reaction. The 1905 revolution, followed by Stolypin's crackdown. Gorbachev's perestroika, followed by the Soviet collapse and then the Putinist retrenchment.
What's different this time, I think, is the ideological content. For most of Russian history, the anti-Western posture was about defending a particular vision of Russian civilization, Orthodox Christianity, the peasant commune, the Tsar as a father figure. The Soviet version was Marxist-Leninist universalism, which was anti-Western but not anti-universalist. They thought they were the future, and the West was the past.
The current ideology is harder to pin down. It borrows from 19th century Slavophilism, Soviet nostalgia, Orthodox traditionalism, and a kind of grievance-driven nationalism. But it doesn't really cohere into a positive vision. It's defined more by what it opposes than what it stands for. The West is decadent, hypocritical, and wants to destroy Russia. That's the core message, and it's repeated constantly across state media.
It resonates, partly because there's genuine historical basis for the grievance. NATO expansion, the bombing of Serbia in 1999, the Iraq War, Libya, the perceived humiliation of the 90s. You don't have to be a Kremlin propagandist to look at the post-Cold War period and feel that Russia's interests were consistently ignored or dismissed by the West.
This is where I think a lot of Western analysis goes wrong. It treats Russian anti-Western sentiment as purely manufactured propaganda, as if the Kremlin just flips a switch and the population obediently hates whoever they're told to hate. But propaganda works when it connects to something real. The sense of being disrespected, of being treated as a defeated power rather than a partner, that's not invented. It's manipulated and weaponized, absolutely, but it's not invented.
The war has supercharged all of this. The sanctions were supposed to cripple the Russian economy and turn the population against the regime. Instead, they've been used by the Kremlin as proof that the West was always trying to destroy Russia, and now the mask is off. The economic pain is real, but it's been framed as a shared sacrifice in an existential struggle.
That framing has been surprisingly effective, but it's also fragile. Strategies report notes that support for the war is broad, but shallow. Most Russians tell pollsters they support it, but they also tell pollsters they want it to end. They're not enthusiastic. They're resigned. And there's a difference between supporting the war in the abstract and being willing to see your son mobilized or your standard of living continue to decline indefinitely.
The Ness Center's election analysis gets at this tension. The Kremlin is worried about the mood, not because they think there's going to be a revolution, but because they built a system that depends on the appearance of popular legitimacy. United Russia needs to win convincingly. Turnout needs to be high. The whole edifice is built on the fiction that the regime enjoys overwhelming popular support.
When that fiction starts to crack, even a little, the elite starts to get nervous. The Jamestown article is really valuable here because it's tracking conversations that are happening in Moscow power circles, not just in the dissident community. There are people with real stakes in the system who are starting to ask, what's the endgame here?
The question of progress after the USSR is complicated by all of this. In material terms, there has been genuine progress. The Soviet Union was a country where you waited in line for toilet paper, and a telephone line could take years to get installed. Modern Russia, at least in the cities, is a consumer society with all the amenities. People have cars, smartphones, access to the internet, foreign travel, at least before the sanctions. That's not nothing.
The cultural opening in the 90s and 2000s was real. Russians could read anything, travel anywhere, engage with global culture in ways that would have been unthinkable in the Soviet period. The internet, before the recent crackdowns, was relatively free. There was a genuine public sphere.
The political progress went in reverse. The 1993 Constitution created a super-presidential system that concentrated power in the executive. The brief democratic opening gave way to managed democracy, then to outright authoritarianism. The independent media that flourished in the 90s has been systematically crushed. The oligarchs who were independent political actors are now either in exile, in prison, or have been reduced to loyal servants of the state.
You've got this paradox, material progress combined with political regression. The country is richer and more connected to the world than it was under the Soviets, but its political system is, in some ways, more repressive than the late Soviet period. Brezhnev's USSR was stagnant and authoritarian, but it didn't throw people in prison for 15 years over a social media post.
The economic progress is uneven to the point of being deceptive. Moscow is a world-class city. It has a good metro system, beautiful parks, excellent restaurants. You can live a very comfortable life there if you have money. But go to a provincial city or a rural village, and it's a different country. The Soviet Union at least maintained a baseline of services everywhere. The post-Soviet state has largely abandoned the periphery.
The healthcare system is a good example. Officially, Russia has universal health care. In practice, the system is underfunded, understaffed, and riddled with corruption. If you need serious medical care, you either pay bribes or you travel to a major city or you die. The Soviet system wasn't great either, but it was functional at a basic level across the entire country.
What about the cultural dimension? One of the things I find most striking about modern Russia is the survival of the intelligentsia tradition. Despite everything, there's still a class of people who define themselves through education, literature, and moral seriousness. They're reading Bulgakov and Brodsky. They're having kitchen table debates about philosophy and history. That's a continuity that goes back to the 19th century.
It's under enormous pressure. The brain drain has hollowed out that class. The people who could leave, the ones with skills and language abilities and savings, a lot of them did leave. What's left is increasingly either regime loyalists who've made their peace with the system, or people who are too old, too poor, or too attached to leave. That middle ground, the critical but not revolutionary intelligentsia, is shrinking.
Which raises the question Daniel is really asking. Is this the permanent condition of Russia, or is it a phase? If you look at the long sweep of history, the current regime is less than a quarter century old. The Soviet period was 70 years. The Romanov dynasty lasted 300 years, and it went through multiple transformations in that time.
I think the historical evidence suggests that Russia is capable of dramatic change, but the change tends to be sudden, violent, and unpredictable. The Soviet Union looked permanent until it wasn't. The Tsarist autocracy looked permanent until 1917. There's a pattern of systems that seem immovable right up until the moment they collapse.
The trigger is usually a crisis that the system can't absorb. War is a recurring one. The Russo-Japanese War triggered the 1905 revolution. World War I triggered the 1917 revolutions. The war in Afghanistan contributed to the Soviet collapse. There's a reason why the current war is being watched so closely as a potential stress point.
It's also important not to be teleological about this. There's no guarantee that the current system collapses, or that if it does, what follows is better. The history of Russian political change is not a story of steady progress toward liberal democracy. It's a story of oscillation between different forms of authoritarianism, with brief and fragile democratic openings.
The 1990s democratic experiment was the longest period of political freedom in Russian history, and it lasted less than a decade. The institutions didn't have time to put down roots. The economic chaos discredited democracy in the eyes of many Russians, who associated it with poverty, crime, and national humiliation.
Where does that leave us? Modern Russia is a country where life is materially better than it was under the Soviets for many people, but politically more repressive than the late Soviet period. The regime's control is deeply entrenched, but also highly personalized and potentially brittle. The anti-Western posture has deep historical roots, but has been weaponized to a degree that's historically unusual. And the trajectory is uncertain, as it always has been throughout Russian history.
I think if you're looking for an overarching framework, the best one is that Russia has always been a country caught between integration with Europe and rejection of Europe, between reform and reaction, between openness and closure. Those tensions aren't going to be resolved. They're constitutive of Russian identity. The question is just where the pendulum is at any given moment, and right now it's swung very far in one direction.
The danger of the current moment is that the pendulum gets stuck. The combination of information control, repression, and genuine popular support for some elements of the regime's agenda creates a kind of equilibrium that's hard to disrupt from within. The Soviet Union had an ideology that eventually exhausted itself. The current system doesn't have a grand ideology. It has grievances and a personality cult. Those can be remarkably durable.
They're also shallow. A grievance-based politics requires a constant supply of grievances. A personality cult requires the personality. Neither of those is a foundation for long-term institutional stability.
One thing I haven't seen enough analysis of is the generational dimension. There are Russians now in their 20s and 30s who have no memory of the Soviet Union, who grew up in the consumer society of the 2000s and 10s, and who are now facing a future of war, sanctions, and isolation. What does that do to a generation's political consciousness?
The emigration wave gives you one answer. Hundreds of thousands of young, educated Russians have voted with their feet. They're in Tbilisi, Yerevan, Istanbul, Dubai, Belgrade. They're building new lives. Whether they ever go back, and what they bring with them if they do, that's one of the big open questions.
For those who stay, it's harder to read. Public opinion polling in an authoritarian system is notoriously unreliable. people tell pollsters what they think is safe to say. But the qualitative evidence, the focus groups, and the sociological studies suggest a lot of cognitive dissonance. People support the president but oppose the war. They're patriotic, but they want their children to have a future. They don't trust the West, but they want to travel.
Which is a very human response to an impossible situation. They focus on their families, their careers, their daily lives. They don't engage with politics because politics is dangerous and feels pointless anyway. That's not enthusiasm for the regime. It's a survival strategy.
It's a strategy that the regime actively encourages. The message is, don't get involved, leave politics to the professionals, focus on your private life. That's a very old authoritarian bargain, and it works until it doesn't.
All right, let's try to land this. If I had to sum up, I'd say modern Russia is a country that has made genuine material progress since the Soviet collapse. But that progress is uneven, fragile, and has come at the cost of political freedom. The regime's control is extensive, but dependent on one man and one set of grievances. The anti-Western posture is not eternal, but it is deeply rooted and currently dominant. And if history is any guide, the current arrangement will eventually change, but there's no reason to assume the change will be peaceful or democratic.
That's a fair summary. I'd add that the thing that makes Russia so hard to analyze is that it's genuinely both more and less than it appears. More resilient than the collapse narrative suggests, but more brittle than the totalitarian monolith narrative suggests. The truth is somewhere in the tension between those poles.
Which is probably where we should leave it. There's no neat conclusion here. Russia is a country that defies neat conclusions.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs approximately 1.1 million pounds, roughly the same as 40 adult elephants floating above your head.
I'm going to be looking up a lot more nervously now.
That's unsettling. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if you're enjoying the show, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be back next time.
Until then, try not to think about the elephants.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.